increasingly popular topic. We are still facing the mindset that animal cognition can only be a poor substitute of what we humans have. It can't be truly deep and amazing. Toward the end of a long career, many a scholar cannot resist shining a light on human talents by listing all the things we are capable of and animals not. From the human perspective, these conjectures may make a satisfactory read. But for anyone interested, as I am, in the full spectrum of cognitions on our planet, they come across as a colossal waste of time. What a bizarre animal we are, that the only question we can ask in relation to our place in nature is, mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the smartest of them all? Keeping humans in their preferred spot on that absurd scale of the ancient Greeks has led to an obsession with semantics, definitions, and redefinitions, and let's face it, the moving of goalposts. Every time we translate low expectations about animals into an experiment, the mirror's favorite answer sounds. Biased comparisons are one ground for suspicion, but the other is the touting of absent evidence. I have lots of negative findings in my own drawers that have never seen the light since I have no idea what they mean. They may indicate the absence of a given capacity in my animals, but most of the time, especially if spontaneous behavior suggests otherwise, I am unsure that I have tested them in the best possible way. I may have created a situation that threw them off, or presented the problem in such an incomprehensible fashion that they didn't even bother to solve it. Recall the low opinion scientists held of gibbon intelligence before their hand anatomy was taken into account, or the premature denials of mirror self-recognition in elephants based on their reaction to an undersized mirror. There are so many ways to account for negative outcomes that it is safer to doubt one's methods before doubting one's subjects. Books and articles commonly state that one of the central issues of evolutionary cognition is to find out what sets us apart. Entire conferences have been organized around the human essence, asking, what makes us human? But is this truly the most fundamental question of our field? I beg to differ. In and of itself, it seems an intellectual dead end. Why would it be any more critical than knowing what sets cockatoos or beluga whales apart? I am reminded of one of Darwin's random musings. He who understands baboon would do more towards metaphysics than Locke. Every single species has profound insights to offer, given that its cognition is the product of the same forces that shaped ours. Imagine a medical textbook that declared that its discipline's central issue is to find out what is unique about the human body. We would roll our eyes. Because even though this question is mildly intriguing, medicine faces far more basic issues related to the functioning of hearts, livers, cells, neural synapses, hormones, and genes. Science seeks to understand not the rat liver or the human liver, but the liver, period. All organs and processes are a great deal older than our species, having evolved over millions of years with a few modifications specific to each organism. Evolution always works like this. Why would cognition be any different? Our first task is to find out how cognition in general operates, which elements it requires to function, and how these elements are attuned to a species' sensory systems and ecology. We want a unitary theory that covers all the various cognitions found in nature. To create space for this project, I recommend placing a moratorium on human uniqueness claims. Given their miserable track record, it is time to rein them in for a few decades. This will allow us to develop a more comprehensive framework. One day, years from now, we may then return to our species' particular case, armed with new concepts that allow a better picture of what is special and what not about the human mind. One aspect we might focus on during this moratorium is an alternative to overly cerebral approaches. I have already mentioned that perspective-taking is likely tied to bodies, and the same applies to imitation. After all, imitation requires that another individual's body movements are perceived and translated into one's own body movements. Mirror neurons, special neurons in the motor cortex that map another's actions onto one's own bodily representations in the brain, are often thought to mediate this process. And it is good to realize that those neurons were discovered not in humans, but in macaques. Even though the precise connection remains a point of debate, imitation likely is a bodily process facilitated by social closeness. This view is quite different from the cerebral one, according to which it all depends on the understanding of cause-effect relations and goals. Thanks to an ingenious experiment by the British primatologist Lydia Hopper, we know which view is correct. Hopper presented chimps with a so-called ghost box controlled by fishing lines. The box magically opened and closed by itself, producing rewards. If technical insight were all that mattered, watching such a box would suffice, as it shows all the necessary actions and consequences. But in fact, letting chimps watch the ghost box ad nauseam taught them nothing. Only after seeing an actual chimp operate the same box did they learn how to get the rewards. Thus, for imitation to occur, apes need to connect to a moving body, preferably one of their own species. Technical understanding is not the key. To find out how bodies interact with cognition, we have incredibly rich material to work with. Adding animals to the mix is bound to stimulate the up-and-coming field of embodied cognition, which postulates that cognition reflects the body's interactions with the world. Until now, this field has been rather human-focused, while failing to take advantage of the fact that the human body is only one of many. Consider the elephant. It combines a very different body with the brain power to achieve high cognition. What is the largest land mammal doing with 3 times as many neurons as our own species? One may downplay this number, arguing that it has to be corrected for body mass, but such corrections are more suited to brain weight than to number of neurons. In fact, it has been proposed that absolute neuron count, regardless of brain or body size, best predicts a species' mental powers. If so, we'd better pay close attention to a species that has vastly more neurons than we do. Since most of these neurons reside in the elephant's cerebellum, some feel they carry less weight, the assumption being that only the prefrontal cortex matters. But why take the way our brain is organized as the measure of all things and look down on subcortical areas? For one thing, we know that during hominoid evolution, our cerebellum expanded even more than our neocortex. This suggests that for our species, too, the cerebellum is critically important. It is now up to us to find out how the remarkable neuron count of the elephant brain serves its intelligence. The trunk, or proboscis, is an extraordinarily sensitive-smelling, grasping, and feeling organ, said to contain 40,000 muscles, coordinated by a unique proboscis nerve that runs along its full length. The trunk has 2 sensitive fingers at the tip, with which it can pick up items as small as a blade of grass. But the trunk also allows the animal to suck up 8 liters of water, or flip over an annoying hippo. True, the cognition associated with this appendage is specialized, but who knows how much of our own cognition is tied to the specifics of our bodies, such as our hands. Would we have evolved the same technical skills and intelligence without these supremely versatile appendages? Some theories of language evolution postulate its origin in manual gestures as well as in neural structures for the throwing of stones and spears. In the same way that humans have a handy intelligence, which we share with other primates, elephants may have a trunky one. There is also the issue of continued evolution. It is a widespread misconception that humans kept evolving while our closest relatives stopped. The only one who stopped, however, is the missing link, the last common ancestor of human and apes, so named because it went extinct long ago. This link will forever remain missing, unless we happen to dig up some fossil remains. I named my research center Living Links, in a wordplay on the missing link, since we study chimpanzees and bonobos as live links to the past. The name has caught on, because there are now a few other Living Links centers in the world. Traits shared across all three species, our two closest ape relatives and ourselves, likely have the same evolutionary roots. But apart from commonalities, all three species also evolved in their own separate ways. Since there is no such thing as halted evolution, all three probably changed substantially. Some of these evolutionary changes gave our relatives an advantage, such as the resistance to the HIV-1 virus that evolved in West African chimps long before the AIDS epidemic devastated humanity. Human immunity has some serious catching up to do. Similarly, all three species, not just ours, had time to evolve cognitive specializations. No natural law says that our species has to be best at everything, which is why we should be prepared for more discoveries such as Ayumu's flash memory or the selective imitative talents of apes. A Dutch educational program recently brought out an advertisement in which human children faced the floating peanut task. Listen to Chapter 3. Even though the members of our species have a bottle of water standing not too far away, they fail to think of the solution until they see a video of apes solving the same problem. Some apes do so spontaneously, even when there is no bottle around to suggest what to do. They walk to the faucet where they know water can be collected. The point of the ad is that schools should teach kids to think outside the box, using apes as an inspiration. The more we know about animal cognition, the more examples of this kind may come to light. The American primatologist Chris Martin at the PRI in Japan has added yet another chimpanzee forte. Using separate computer screens, he had apes play a competitive game that required them to anticipate one another's moves. Could they outguess their rivals based on their previous choices? A bit like the rock-paper-scissors game. Martin had humans play the same game. The chimps outperformed the humans, reaching optimal performance more quickly and completely than members of our own species. The scientists attributed the edge to chimps being quicker at predicting a rival's moves and countermoves. This finding resonated with me, given what I know about the politics and preemptive tactics of chimpanzees. Chimp status is based on alliances in which males support one another. Reigning alpha males protect their power by a divide-and-rule strategy, and they particularly hate it when one of their rivals cozies up to one of their own supporters. They try to forestall hostile collusions. Moreover, not unlike presidential candidates who hold babies up in the air as soon as the cameras are rolling, male chimps vying for power develop a sudden interest in infants, which they hold and tickle in order to curry favor with the females. Female support can make a huge difference in rivalries among males, so making a good impression on them is important. Given the tactical shrewdness of chimpanzees, it is a great advance that computer games now help us put these remarkable skills to the test. We have no good reason to focus solely on chimpanzees, though. They often serve as a starting point, but chimpocentrism is a mere extension of anthropocentrism. Why not focus on other species that lend themselves to explore specific aspects of cognition? We could focus on a small number of organisms as test cases. We already do so in medicine and general biology. Geneticists exploit fruit flies and zebrafish, and students of neural development have gotten much mileage out of research on nematode worms. Not everyone realizes that science works this way, which is why scientists were dumbfounded by the complaint of former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin that tax dollars were going to useless projects such as fruit fly research in Paris, France. I kid you not. It may sound silly to some, but the humble Drosophila has long been our main workhorse in genetics, yielding insight in the relation between chromosomes and genes. A small set of animals produces basic knowledge applicable to many other species, including ourselves. The same applies to cognitive research, such as the way rats and pigeons have shaped our view of memory. I imagine a future in which we explore a range of capacities in specific organisms on the assumption of generalizability. We may end up studying technical skills in New Caledonian crows and Capuchin monkeys, conformity in guppies, empathy in canids, object categorization in parrots, and so on. Yet all this requires that we circumvent the fragile human ego and treat cognition like any other biological phenomenon. If cognition's basic features derive from gradual descent with modification, then notions of leaps, bounds, and sparks are out of order. Instead of a gap, we face a gently sloping beach created by the steady pounding of millions of waves. Even if human intellect is higher up on the beach, it was shaped by the same forces battering the same shore. Chapter 6. Social Skills. The old male faced a choice worthy of a politician. Every day, Yaron was being groomed by two rivaling males, each one eager to gain his backing. He seemed to enjoy the attention. Being groomed by the mighty alpha male, the one who had deposed him a year earlier, was utterly relaxing, because no one would dare disturb them. But being groomed by the second, younger male was tricky. Their get-togethers greatly upset Alpha, who regarded them as plots against himself and tried to disrupt them. Alpha would put up all his hair and hoot and display around, banging doors and hitting females, until the other two males became so nervous that they'd break up and leave the scene. Separating them was the only way to calm down Alpha. Since male chimps never cease to jockey for position and are always making and breaking pacts, innocent grooming sessions don't really exist. Every single one carries political implications. The current alpha male enjoyed massive popularity and support, including that of the old matriarch, Mama, leader of the females. If Yaron had wanted an easy life, he would have opted to play sidekick to this male. He wouldn't have rocked the boat, and there would never have been any threat to his position. Aligning himself with the ambitious young male, on the other hand, was fraught with risk. However big and muscular this male might be, he had barely left his adolescence behind. He was an untried entity who carried so little authority that whenever he tried to break up a female fight, as top males are wont to do, he risked the wrath of both contestants. Ironically, this meant that he did resolve the discord, but at his own expense. Instead of screaming at one another, the females now supported one another in chasing the would-be arbitrator. Once they got him cornered, however, they were smart enough not to physically grapple with him, being all too familiar with his speed, strength, and canine teeth. He had become a player to be reckoned with. The alpha male, in contrast, was so skilled at peacekeeping, so impartial in his interventions, and so protective of the underdog that he had become immensely beloved. He had brought peace and harmony to the group after a long period of upheaval. Females were always ready to groom him and let him play with their children. They were likely to resist anyone who dared challenge his reign. Nonetheless, this is exactly what Yaron went for when he sided with the young upstart. The two of them entered a long campaign to dethrone the established leader that took a great toll in tensions and injuries. Whenever the young male would position himself at some distance from the alpha male, provoking him with increasingly loud hooting, Yaron would go sit right behind the challenger, wrap his arms around his middle, and softly hoot along. This way there was no doubt about his allegiance. Mama and her female friends did resist this revolt, occasionally resulting in massive pursuits of both troublemakers. But the combination of the young male's brawn and Yaron's brain was too much. From the start, it was obvious that Yaron was not out to claim the alpha position for himself, but was content to let his partner do the dirty work. They never backed down, and after several months of daily confrontations, the young male became the new alpha. The two of them ruled for years, with Yaron acting like a Dick Cheney or a Ted Kennedy, a power behind the throne. He remained so influential that as soon as his support began to waver, the throne wobbled. This happened occasionally after conflicts over sexually attractive females. The new alpha quickly learned that in order to keep Yaron on his side, he'd need to grant him privileges. Most of the time, Yaron was allowed to mate with females, something the young alpha did not tolerate from any other male. Why did Yaron throw his support behind this parvenu instead of joining the established power? It is informative to look at studies of human coalition formation, in which players win games through cooperation, and to study the balance of power theories about international pacts. The basic principle here is the strength is weakness paradox, according to which the most powerful player is often the least attractive political ally, because this player doesn't really need others, hence takes them for granted, and treats them like dirt. In Yaron's case, the established alpha male was too mighty for his own good. By joining him, Yaron would have gained little, because all this male truly needed was his neutrality. The smarter strategy was to pick a partner who couldn't win without him. By throwing his weight behind the young male, Yaron became the kingmaker. He regained both prestige and fresh mating opportunities. Machiavellian intelligence. When I began observing the world's largest chimpanzee colony at Burgert's Zoo in 1975, I had no idea that I'd be working with this species for the rest of my life. Just so, as I sat on a wooden stool watching primates on a forested island for an estimated 10,000 hours, I had no idea that I'd never again enjoy that luxury. Nor did I realize that I would develop an interest in power relations. In those days, university students were firmly anti-establishment, and I had the shoulder-long hair to prove it. We considered ambition ridiculous and power evil. My observations of the chimps, however, made me question the idea that hierarchies were merely cultural institutions, a product of socialization, something we could wipe out at any moment. They seemed more ingrained. I had no trouble detecting the same tendencies in even the most hippie-like organizations. They were generally run by young men who mocked authority and preached egalitarianism, yet had no qualms about ordering everyone else around and stealing their comrades' girlfriends. It wasn't the chimps who were odd, but the humans who seemed dishonest. Political leaders have a habit of concealing their power motives behind nobler desires, such as a readiness to serve the nation and improve the economy. When the English political philosopher Thomas Hobbes postulated the existence of an insuppressible power drive, he was right on target for both humans and apes. The biological literature proved to be of no help understanding the social maneuvering that I observed, so I turned to Niccolò Machiavelli. During quiet moments of observation, I read from a book that had been published more than four centuries earlier. The Prince put me in the right frame of mind to interpret what I was seeing on the chimpanzee's forested island, though I'm pretty sure the Florentine philosopher never envisioned this particular application. Among chimpanzees, hierarchy permeates everything. Whenever we set out to bring two females inside the building, as we often do for testing, one will be ready to get going on the task at hand, while the other will hang back. The second female will barely take rewards, and won't touch the puzzle box, computer, or whatever else we're using. She may be just as eager as the other, but she defers to her superior. There is no tension or hostility between them, and out in the group they may be the best of friends. One female simply dominates the other. Among the males, in contrast, power is always up for grabs. It is not conferred on the basis of age or any other trait, but has to be fought for and jealously guarded against contenders. Soon after my long stint as a chronicler of their social affairs, I put pencil to paper to produce Chimpanzee Politics, a popular account of the power struggles that I had witnessed. I was risking my nascent academic career by ascribing intelligent social maneuvering to animals, an implication I had been trained to avoid at all cost. That doing well in a group full of rivals, friends, and relatives requires considerable social skill is something we now take for granted. But in those days, animal social behavior was rarely thought of as intelligent. Observers would recount a rank reversal between two baboons, for example, in passive terms, as if it happened to them rather than was brought about by them. They would make no mention of one baboon following the other around, provoking one confrontation after another, flashing his huge canine teeth, and recruiting help from nearby males. It is not that the observers did not notice, but animals were not supposed to have goals and strategies, so the reports remained silent. Deliberately breaking with this tradition, describing chimps as schmoozing and scheming Machiavellians, my book drew wide attention and enjoyed many translations. The U.S. Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, even put it on the recommended reading list for freshman congressmen. The account met with far less resistance than I had dreaded, including from fellow primatologists. Obviously, the time was ripe, in 1982, for a more cognitive approach to animal social behavior. Even though I learned about it only after my own book, Donald Griffin's Animal Awareness had come out just a few years before. My work was part of a new zeitgeist, and I had a handful of predecessors to lean on. There was Emil Menzel, whose work on chimpanzee cooperation and communication postulated goals and hinted at intelligent solutions, and Hans Kummer, who never ceased to wonder what drove his baboons to act the way they did. Kummer wanted to know, for example, how baboons plan their travel routes, and who decides where to go, those in front or those in the back. He broke down the behavior into recognizable mechanisms, and stressed how social relationships serve as long-term investments. More than anyone before him, Kummer combined classical ethology with questions about social cognition. I was also impressed by In the Shadow of Man, by a young British primatologist. By the time I read it, I was familiar enough with chimpanzees to be unsurprised by the specifics of Jane Goodall's description of life at Gombe Stream in Tanzania. But the tone of her account was truly refreshing. She did not necessarily spell out the cognition of her subjects, but it was impossible to read about Mike, a rising male who impressed his rivals by loudly banging empty kerosene cans together, or the love life and family relations of matriarch Flo, without recognizing a complex psychology. Goodall's apes had personalities, emotions, and social agendas. She did not unduly humanize them, but she related what they did in unpretentious prose that would have been perfectly normal for a day at the office, but was unorthodox with regard to animals. It was a huge improvement over the tendency at the time to drown behavioral descriptions in quotation marks and dense jargon in order to avoid mentalistic implications. Even animal names and genders were often avoided. Every individual was an it. Goodall's apes, in contrast, were social agents with names and faces. Rather than being the slaves of their instincts, they acted as the architects of their own destinies. Her approach perfectly fit my own budding understanding of chimpanzee social life. Yaron's allegiance to the young alpha was a case in point. Not that I could resolve how and why he had made his choice, in the same way that it was impossible for Goodall to know if Mike's career might have been different in the absence of kerosene cans, but both stories implied deliberate tactics. Pinpointing the cognition behind such behavior requires collecting a mass of systematic data, as well as performing experiments, such as the strategic computer games that we now know chimps are extraordinarily good at. Let me briefly offer two examples of how these issues may be tackled. The first concerns a study at the Burkert's Zoo itself. Conflicts in the colony rarely remained restricted to the original two contestants, since chimps have a tendency to draw others into the fray. Sometimes 10 or more chimps would be running around, threatening and chasing one another, uttering high-pitched screams that could be heard a mile away. Naturally, every contestant tried to get as many allies on his or her side as possible. When I analyzed hundreds of videotaped incidents, a new technique at the time, I found that the chimpanzees who were losing the battle beseeched their friends by stretching out an open hand to them. They tried to recruit support in order to turn things around. When it came to the friends of their enemies, however, they went out of their way to appease them by putting an arm around them and kissing their face or shoulder. Instead of begging for assistance, they sought to neutralize them. To know the friends of your opponents takes experience. It implies that individual A is aware not only of her own relations with B and C, but also of the relation between B and C. I dubbed this triadic awareness since it reflects knowledge of the entire ABC triangle. It is the same with us when we realize who is married to whom, who is a son of whom, or who is the employer of whom. Human society could not function without triadic awareness. The second example concerns wild chimpanzees. It is well known that there is no obvious connection between a male's rank and his size. The biggest, meanest male does not automatically reach the top. A small male with the right friends also has a shot at the alpha position. This is why male chimps put so much effort into alliance formation. In an analysis of years of data collected at Gombe, a relatively small alpha male spent far more time grooming others than did larger males in the same position. Apparently, the more a male's position depends on support from third parties, the more energy he needs to invest into diplomacy, such as grooming. In his study in the Mahale Mountains, not far from Gombe, Toshisada Nishida and his team of Japanese scientists observed an alpha male with an exceptionally long tenure of more than a decade. This male developed a bribery system, selectively sharing prized monkey meat with his loyal allies, while denying such favors to his rivals. Years after chimpanzee politics, these studies confirmed the tit-for-tat deal-making that I had implied. But even while I was writing my book, supportive data were being gathered. Unknown to me, Nishida had followed an older male at Mahale named Kalunde, who had moved himself into a key position by playing off younger competitive males against one another. These young males sought Kalunde's support, which he handed out rather erratically, making himself indispensable to the advancement of any one of them. Being the dethroned alpha male, Kalunde made a comeback of sorts. But like Yaron, he didn't claim the top position for himself. He rather acted as power behind the scenes. The situation was so eerily similar to the saga I had described that I was thrilled, 2 decades later, to meet Kalunde in person. Toshi, as the late Nishida was known to his friends, invited me for some field work, which I gladly accepted. He was one of the world's greatest chimpanzee experts, and it was a treat to follow him around through the jungle. Living in the camp near Lake Tanganyika, one realizes that running water, electricity, toilets, and telephones are greatly overrated. It is entirely possible to survive without them. Every day the goal was to get up early, eat a quick breakfast, and get going before the sun rose. The chimps would have to be found, and the camp had several trackers to assist us. Fortunately, chimps are incredibly noisy, which makes them easy to locate. Chimps do not travel all in a single group, but are spread out over separately traveling parties of just a few individuals each. In an environment with low visibility, they rely heavily on vocalizations to stay in touch. Following an adult male, for example, you continuously see him stop, cock his head, and listen to others in the distance. You see him decide how to respond by replying with his own calls, silently moving toward the source, sometimes in such a hurry that you are left struggling through tangled vines, or continue on his merry way as if what he just heard lacked any relevance. By then, Kalunde was the oldest male, only about half the size of a prime adult male. Being around 40, he had shrunk. But despite his advanced age, he was still into political games, frequently accompanying and grooming the beta male, until Alpha returned from a long period of absence. Alpha had traveled to the fringes of the community territory, escorting a sexually receptive female. High-ranking males may go for weeks on end on safari with a female, as it is known, in order to avoid competition. I knew about Alpha's unexpected return only because Toshi told me in the evening, but I had noticed great agitation in the males that I had been following the whole day. They were restless, running up and down the hills, totally exhausting me. Alpha's characteristic hooting and drumming on empty trees had announced his return, making everyone hyper-nervous. In the following days, it was fascinating to see Kalunde switching camps. One moment he would be grooming the returning Alpha, the next he'd be hanging out with the beta male, as if trying to decide which side he should be on. He offered the perfect illustration of a tactic that Toshi had dubbed Allegiance Fickleness. You can imagine that we had much to talk about, especially comparing wild versus zoo chimps. Obviously, there are major differences, but it is not as simple as some people think, especially those who wonder why one would study captive animals at all. The goals of both types of research are quite different, and we need both. Fieldwork is essential to understanding the natural social life of any animal. For anyone who wants to know how and why their typical behavior evolved, there is no substitute for observing them in their natural habitat. I have visited many field sites, from capuchin monkeys in Costa Rica and woolly spider monkeys in Brazil, to orangutans in Sumatra, baboons in Kenya, and Tibetan macaques in China. I find it very informative to see the ecology of wild primates and to hear from colleagues what sort of issues they are fascinated by. Fieldwork is nowadays very systematic and scientific. The days of a few scribbled observations in a notebook are gone. Data collection is continuous and systematic, typed into handheld digital devices and complemented with fecal and urine samples that allow DNA analysis and hormone assays. All this hard, sweaty work has enormously advanced our understanding of wild animal societies. Yet in order to get at behavioral details and the cognition behind them, we need more than field work. No one would try to measure a child's intelligence by watching him run around in a schoolyard with his friends. Mere observation doesn't offer much of a peek into the child's mind. Instead, we bring the child into a room and present him with a coloring task or a computer game, let her stack wooden blocks, ask questions, and so on. This is how we measure human cognition, and it is also the best way to determine how smart apes are. Fieldwork offers hints and suggestions, but rarely allows firm conclusions. One may encounter wild chimpanzees who crack nuts with stones, for example, but it is impossible to know how they discovered this technique or how they learn it from one another. For this, we need carefully controlled experiments on naive chimpanzees who receive nuts and stones for the first time. Captive apes under enlightened conditions, such as a sizable group in a spacious outdoor area, have the added advantage of providing a close-up look at naturalistic behavior that one can't get in the field. Here, apes can be watched and videotaped much more fully than is possible in the forest, where primates often disappear into the undergrowth or canopy as soon as things get interesting. Field workers are often left to reconstruct events based on fragmented observations. To do so is an art, and they are very good at it, but it falls short of the behavioral detail routinely collected in captivity. If one studies facial expressions, for example, zoomed-in, high-definition videos that can be slowed down are essential, which require well-lit conditions rarely encountered in the field. No wonder the study of social behavior and cognition has fostered integration between captive and fieldwork. The two represent different pieces of the same puzzle. Ideally, we use evidence from both sources to support cognitive theories. Observations in the field have often inspired experiments in the lab. Conversely, observations in captivity, such as the discovery that chimpanzees reconcile after fights, have stimulated observations in the field on the same phenomenon. If, on the other hand, experimental outcomes clash with what is known about a species' behavior in the wild, it may be time to try a new approach. With regard to the question of animal culture in particular, captive and field work are now often combined. Naturalists document geographic variation in the behavior of a given species, suggesting a local origin and transmission, but they often cannot rule out alternative accounts, such as genetic variation between populations, which is why we need experiments to determine if habits can spread by one individual watching another. Is the species capable of imitation? If so, this greatly strengthens the case for cultural learning in the field. Nowadays, we move back and forth all the time between both sources of evidence. But all these interesting developments happened long after my observations at Burkert's Zoo. Following Coomer's example, my goal at the time was to spell out what social mechanisms may underlie observed behavior. Apart from triadic awareness, I spoke of divide-and-rule strategies, policing by dominant males, reciprocal deal-making, deception, reconciliation after fights, consolation of distressed parties, and so on. I developed such a long list of proposals that I devoted the rest of my career to fleshing them out, at first through detailed observations, but later also experimentally. Proposals take so much less time to make than their verification. The latter can be very instructive, though. One can set up experiments, for example, in which one individual can do another one favors, as we did with our Capuchin monkeys, but then add a condition in which the partner can do favors in return. This allows favors to travel in both directions between two parties. We found that monkeys become noticeably more generous if favors can be done mutually than if only one of them has the opportunity. I love this kind of manipulation, since it allows far more solid conclusions about reciprocity than any observational account. Observations never quite clinch the deal the way experiments can. Even though chimpanzee politics opened a new agenda for research while introducing Machiavelli's thinking to primatology, I was never quite happy with Machiavellian intelligence as a popular label for this field. This term implies an end justifies the means manipulation of others, ignoring a vast amount of social knowledge and understanding that has nothing to do with one-upmanship. When a female chimpanzee resolves a fight between two juveniles over a leafy branch by breaking it into two and handing each youngster a piece, or when an adult male chimpanzee helps an injured, limping mother by picking up her offspring to carry it for her, we are dealing with impressive social skills that don't fit the Machiavellian label. This cynical identifier made sense a few decades ago, when all animal, including human, life was customarily depicted as competitive, nasty, and selfish. But over time, my own interests have drifted into the opposite direction. I have devoted most of my research to the exploration of empathy and cooperation. The exploitation of others by using them as social tools remains a great topic and is an undeniable aspect of primate sociality, but it is too narrow a focus for the field of social cognition as a whole. Caring relationships, the maintenance of bonds, and attempts to keep the peace are equally worthy of attention. The intelligence required to effectively deal with social networks may explain why the primate order underwent its remarkable brain expansion. Primates have exceptionally large brains. Dubbed the social brain hypothesis by British zoologist Robin Dunbar, the connection with sociality is supported by a relation between a primate's brain size and its typical group size. Primates that live in larger groups generally have larger brains. I always find it hard, though, to separate social and technical intelligence, since many big-brained species are strong in both domains. Even species that hardly handle any tools in the wild, such as rooks and bonobos, may be quite good at it in captivity. It remains true, though, that social challenges have been neglected for too long in discussions of cognitive evolution, which tend to focus on interactions with the environment. Given how all-important social problem-solving is in the lives of our subjects, primatologists have been right to amend this view. Triadic awareness. Siamangs, large black members of the gibbon family, swing high up in the tallest trees of the Asian jungle. Every morning the male and female burst into spectacular duets. Their song begins with a few loud whoops, which gradually build into ever louder, more elaborate sequences. Amplified by balloon-like throat sacs, the sound carries far and wide. I have heard them in Indonesia, where the whole forest echoed with their sound. The siamangs listen to one another during breaks. Whereas most territorial animals need only know where their boundaries run and how strong and healthy their neighbors are, siamangs face the added complexity that territories are jointly defended by pairs. This means that pair bonds matter. Troubled pairs will be weak defenders, while bonded pairs will be strong ones. Since the song of a pair reflects their marriage, the more beautiful it is, the more their neighbors realize not to mess with them. A close harmony duet communicates not only stay out, but also we're one. If a pair duets poorly, on the other hand, uttering discordant vocalizations that interrupt one another, neighbors hear an opportunity to move in and exploit the pair's troubled relationship. To understand how others relate to one another is a basic social skill that is even more important for group living animals. They deal with a far greater variety than the siamang. In a baboon or macaque troop, for example, a female's rank in the hierarchy is almost entirely decided by the family from which she hails. Owing to a tight network of friends and kin, no female escapes the rules of the matrilineal order, according to which daughters born to high-ranking mothers will themselves become high-ranking, while daughters from families at the bottom will also end up at the bottom. As soon as one female attacks another, third parties move in to defend the one or the other so as to reinforce the existing kinship system. The youngest members of the top families know this all too well. Born with a silver spoon in their mouths, they freely provoke fights with everyone around, knowing that even the biggest, meanest female of a lower clan will not be allowed to assert herself against them. The youngster's screams will mobilize her powerful mother and sisters. In fact, it has been shown that screams sound different depending on the kind of opponent a monkey confronts. Thus, it is immediately clear to the entire troop whether a noisy fight fits or violates the established order. The social knowledge of wild monkeys has been tested by playing the distress calls of a juvenile from a loudspeaker hidden in the bushes at a moment when the juvenile itself is out of sight. Hearing this sound, nearby adults not only look in the direction of the speaker, but also peek at the juvenile's mother. They recognize the juvenile's voice and seem to connect it with its mother, perhaps wondering what she is going to do about the trouble her offspring is in. The same sort of social knowledge can be seen at more spontaneous moments, when a juvenile female picks up an infant that is unsteadily walking about, only to carry it back to its mother, which means that she knows which female the infant belongs to. In white-faced capuchin monkeys, the American anthropologist Susan Perry analyzed how individuals form coalitions during fights. Having followed these hyperactive monkeys for over two decades, Susan knows them all by name and life history. During a visit to her field site in Costa Rica, I saw the characteristic coalition stance firsthand. Known as the Overlord, two monkeys threaten a third with stares and wide-open mouths, one leaning on top of the other. Their opponent thus faces an intimidating display of two monkeys wrapped into one, with both threatening heads stacked on top of each other. Comparing these coalitions with known social ties, Susan found that Capuchins preferentially recruit friends who are dominant over their opponent. This, by itself, is rather logical. But she also found that instead of seeking the support of their best buddies, they specifically recruit those who are closer to themselves than to their opponent. They seem to realize that there is no point appealing to their opponent's buddies. This tactic, too, requires triadic awareness. Capuchins solicit support by abruptly jerking their heads back and forth between a potential supporter and their adversary, a behavior known as head flagging, which is also used against danger, such as a snake. In fact, these monkeys threaten everything they don't like, a tendency sometimes used to manipulate attention. Susan once observed the following deceptive sequence. Pursued by a coalition of three higher-ranking males, Guapo suddenly stopped in his tracks and began to produce frantic snake alarm calls while looking at the ground. I was standing by him and could plainly see that there was nothing there but bare ground. He head-flagged to Curmudgeon, one of his enemies, for support against the imaginary snake. Guapo's pursuers stopped short and stood up on their hind legs to see if there was a snake. After cautious inspection, they once again began threatening Guapo. Switching tactics, he glanced up at a passing magpie jay, a non-menacing bird, and did three bird alarms in rapid succession, calls that are usually reserved for large raptors and owls. Guapo's opponents looked up, saw that it was not a dangerous bird, and again resumed threatening Guapo. He reverted to the snake alarm call tactic once again, vehemently bouncing at the bare patch of ground, threatening the snake vocally. Although Curmudgeon continued to glare at Guapo for a bit longer, the rest of the group stopped threatening him, and he was able to resume foraging for insects, moving slowly and nonchalantly towards Curmudgeon, while occasionally casting a furtive glance in his direction. While such observations suggest but cannot prove high intelligence, there is an urgent need for information on the cognition of wild primates. Field workers are finding ingenious ways to collect it. In Budongo Forest in Uganda, for example, Katie Slocum and Klaus Zuber-Buhler set out to record the screams of chimpanzees under threat or attack. These loud vocalizations serve to recruit aid, which prompted the scientists to see if the acoustics of screams depend on the audience. Given the dispersed lives of wild chimpanzees, only individuals who are within earshot, the audience, are likely to provide aid to a screaming victim. In addition to finding that the intensity of the calls reflected the intensity of the attack, the scientists noted a subtle deception encoded in them. Chimpanzee victims apparently exaggerate their screams, making the attack sound more severe than it truly is, provided their audience includes individuals that outrank their attacker. In other words, whenever the big bosses are around, chimp victims scream bloody murder. Their vocal distortion of the truth suggests precise knowledge of their opponent's status relative to everyone else. More evidence that primates know one another's relationships comes from the way they classify others based on family membership. Some studies have explored their tendency to redirect aggression. Recipients of aggression often look for a scapegoat, not unlike the way people who get reprimanded at work may come home to maltreat their spouse and children. Given their strict hierarchies, macaques are a prime example. As soon as one of these monkeys gets threatened or chased, it will threaten or chase somebody else, always an easy target. Redirected hostility thus travels down the pecking order. Remarkably, redirecting monkeys prefer to target the family of the original aggressor. One monkey will be attacked by a high-ranking individual, Then look around to spot a younger, less powerful member of her attacker's family to take her tensions out on this poor soul. This way, redirection resembles revenge, since it makes the family of the instigator pay. The same knowledge of family relations also serves more constructive purposes, such as when, after a fight between two monkeys of different families, tensions are resolved by other members of the same families. Thus, if play between two juveniles turns into a screaming fight, their mothers may get together to make up for their children. It is an ingenious system, but again, it requires every monkey to know to which family every other monkey belongs. Categorizing others into families may be a case of stimulus equivalence, as proposed by the late Ronald Shusterman, an American marine mammal specialist. Ron kept the strangest and most delightful animal laboratory that I have ever set a slippery foot in, since it consisted of not much more than an outdoor swimming pool in sunny Santa Cruz, California. It was the ultimate wet lab. To the side of the pool stood a few wooden panels on which symbols could be mounted for his sea lions. The animals swam in the pool, racing around faster than any human ever could, only to jump out for a few seconds and touch a symbol with their wet noses. Ron's star performer was his favorite pinniped, named Rio. If Rio made the right choice, a fish would be thrown at her, and she'd dive right back into the pool. She did all this in one fluid movement, catching the fish while sliding back into the water, reflecting perfect coordination between experimenter and subject. Ron explained that most tests were too simple for Rio, resulting in her getting bored and losing her concentration. Making errors, she'd get mad at Ron for not giving her enough fish and angrily toss all her plastic toys out of the pool. Rio had learned to associate arbitrary symbols. She'd first learned that symbol A belongs with B, then that B belongs with C, and so on. After rewarding her for making the right connections, Ron would surprise her with a brand new combination, such as A and C. If A and B are equivalent, as well as B and C, then A and C must be equivalent too. Would Rio extrapolate from the previous associations and group A, B, and C together? She did, applying this logic to combinations that she had never encountered before. Ron saw this as the prototype of how animals may mentally group individuals together, such as families or cliques. We do the same. If you learn to connect me first with one of my brothers, then also with another one, I have five, you should also group those two brothers together in the same family, even if you have never encountered them together. Equivalence learning makes for quick and efficient categorization. Ron went further, speculating about other unseen connections. For example, chimpanzee males have been known to angrily attack and destroy the empty night nests that rival males have left behind in trees at the border of their territory. Unable to attack the enemy itself, the next best target is apparently a nest that they have built. It reminds me of a time in the Netherlands when owners of black Suzuki Swifts had a tough time. They suffered frequent nasty remarks from people, and worse, such as intentional damage to their cars. This situation arose after someone with murderous intentions had driven a black Suzuki Swift into a festive crowd on Queen's Day, killing 8 people. The car itself was obviously not at fault, but humans are quick to connect the dots. A hated action turned a specific car brand into a hated object. It all boiled down to stimulus equivalence. Knowing as we do the spontaneous use of triadic awareness, the next question is how it is acquired. To find out, we need experiments. Is it enough for animals to just watch others? In one study, the French psychologist Dalila Beauvais rewarded rhesus monkeys at Georgia State University for identifying the dominant monkey in a video. The observing monkeys didn't know the individuals they were watching and had to judge their relationship purely on the basis of behavior. For example, one monkey in the video would chase another, after which the observer would be trained to select the dominant one, the one who had done the chasing, on a freeze frame of the scene. After learning to do this, the observing monkeys generalized to behaviors that didn't look like chasing, but also indicated dominance. Subordinate rhesus monkeys, for example, communicate their position to the dominant by bearing